The Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place via House Rule 10.01. The clerk will take the roll. I'm not hearing your voice. I see your still no sound.
How about now?
That's it.
Okay. Present. Houseman?
Present.
Howard?
Present.
Tice?
Present.
Agbijay?
Present.
Liz?
Present.
Gomez?
Present.
Hassan?
Present.
Heinrich?
Present.
Herr?
Present.
Jurgens?
Present.
Olson?
Present.
Barr?
Present.
And Ryer?
Present.
Madam Chair, that is all of our members.
And a quorum is present. Next order of business is the approval of the minutes from Tuesday, January 12th. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, and we'll move the minutes.
Representative Howard moves approval of the minutes. Any members who have any corrections? If not, members, we can approve this motion by voice vote. So if you unmute yourself, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. If we have everybody on board, the next order of the business is going to be Homes for All, and we have a number of testifiers with that group. And testifiers, as you begin your testimony in each case, please identify yourself for the record, and members will take questions after each presentation is completed. First of all, though, I'd like to just call a couple of things to your attention. You should have received an email from Owen Wirth, our committee administrator, that has all the attachments, all the PowerPoints for today. And I'd like to give a little bit of history going back to 2012. At that point, there was very little state effort in housing. General obligation bonds for public housing, we would maybe do $5 million a year, if that. And then two things changed. I can remember Tanya Orr, who at that time was working for Minnesota Housing. She came to my office and she said, general obligation bonds have to be publicly owned. So that's why we could only do public housing. She said, if we could use our bonding authority in the agency and do housing infrastructure bonds, that would allow us to partner with nonprofits, Lutheran Social Service, Common Bond, Aon, and others. And we could do so much more. And at that point, then housing infrastructure bonds became another tool that we used. In addition, what was happening is many advocacy groups would come into our offices and advocate for their particular need relative to housing. And there were so many people coming in about housing that kind of legislators' eyes would glaze over. Well, didn't I just have an appointment around housing? And so there was a year we got nothing because there were so many voices and no kind of cohesive effort. And I can remember visiting with housing advocates at the time to say, don't ever let this happen again. Work in the interim, sit around a table, figure out what your agenda is, and then come with a common agenda. And they did it. They actually did it. They organized, and now we have the Homes for All Coalition that we'll be hearing from this morning. And that has helped us come with a more unified voice. So a couple of things changed since 2012 that have allowed us to do a bit more. So my understanding is that Pastor Sue Kesterman and Chad Adams are Homes for All co-chairs, and that they are going to start by presenting the agenda. Pastor is Kesterman, I don't know if it's I'm pronouncing that correctly. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Yes, it is Pastor Sue Kesterman, and thank you, Chair Hausman and committee members. Good morning. My name is Pastor Sue Kesterman, and I am the Chief Executive Officer at Churches United, located in Moorhead. We provide safe shelter, stable housing, nutritious food and a path to healing for our neighbors in need in the Moorhead-Fargo area. You'll note I put Moorhead first because that's where my roots are, is here in Minnesota. I also have the privilege of serving as one of the co-chairs for the Homes for All Coalition. And we are so very thankful for the opportunity to join you today and appreciate the invitation. Many of you are likely familiar with the statewide Homes for All Coalition, but I want to take a moment to reintroduce the coalition. Founded in 2011, Homes for All brings together more than 270 organizations from around the state around a united cause, increasing access and resources to housing in Minnesota. The coalition is comprised of faith-based organizations, service providers, affordable housing developers and providers, organizations from the disability community, mental health providers, private entities, philanthropic organizations, nonprofits, local units of government, and many others from all around the state of Minnesota. We are so thankful to all of you for your support over the years, and we are asking you to again join us in supporting the Homes for All agenda for the 2021 legislative session. We all wish that we could solve housing instability and homelessness with the snap of our fingers, but the issues people face are complex, unique, and often perpetuated by systems and societal norms that have been unfair, particularly to our Black, Indigenous, and communities of color communities. For these reasons, our agenda is broad and expands the full continuum of housing. You will hear from one of our partners and endorsing members, the Minnesota Housing Partnership, later in the hearing about some of the research and statistics that will be helpful when thinking about the housing needs in our state. While we won't get into the specifics of our agenda today, we will provide an overview. Homes for All is committed to protecting rights and advancing equity for our unhoused neighbors, particularly those who are unsheltered or in shelters, as well as renters. To achieve this, we are advocating for game-changing legislation, including a Shelter Residents Bill of Rights, preventing sources of income discrimination, and eviction reforms. The coalition is also advocating for additional resources to support our shelters and services needed to help transition and stabilize people as they move from homelessness into housing.
And members, if you note, there's a dollar sign by some. So the dollar sign indicates that is funding that will be sought. Others without the dollar sign are policy.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Many programs have been underfunded for years, and that is why we are seeking funding increases to proven programs like the Emergency Services Program, ESP, the Housing Supports Program, formerly GRH, and Bridges. We know that in order to achieve these policy and funding changes, we need to have effective conversations with all of you and with key stakeholders. And we need to seek adequate budget targets. Homes for All Coalition members are committed to this work because we know that the needs are so great, and that where we live impacts every part of our lives. Finally, we are constantly striving to be more inclusive and representative. We are especially thankful to those with a lived experience of homelessness and housing crisis. They help not only to inform our work, but increasingly they drive the direction in which the coalition is heading. I'd especially like to thank all of you who are with us today for sharing your important personal perspective and helping to highlight specific areas of our agenda. If there are no questions at this point, I would thank you again for the opportunity to testify. And in a moment, I'll turn it over to Tyra Thomas, but I'm happy to respond to any questions. Representative Hausman, I believe you're muted.
I should stay unmuted. I just wondered if Mr. Adams is speaking at all.
I believe Chad is going to join us towards the end.
Okay. So we are, I think we'll take all the testifiers and then we'll open it for questions. So is it Tyra Thomas?
Tyra Thomas is next up. Thank
you
very much.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Tyra Thomas. And first I'd like to thank Homes for All for allowing us to team up with them to change conditions that are in shelter and find solutions. Street Voices of Change came together 4 years ago over conditions at shelters. My experience at shelters was traumatic. Understaffed, not enough mediation, verbal abuse, physical abuse, and even saw financial exploitation. The Shelter Residents Bill of Rights came together from gathering with my brothers and sisters in homelessness to make a change, make things better at shelters. Shelters are so needed. As we experienced over the summer here with the encampments, a lot of folks in encampments, their responses were the same. They had to pay all their money. The rules were quite restrictive. People who were coupling could not be together, especially if they were caregiving. And then also folks that felt trauma at shelters who were treated unfairly. The Shelter Residents Bill of Rights came together so that people are to be ensured to be treated with dignity and respect, and all parties, including guests as well, are held accountable to make that place supportive, and folks can recover from being displaced and get the strength to resolve their housing issues. I want to thank Homes for All for allowing us to come together to do this really important work, because I know that there will be a time where, you know, it might not be a rent issue. I might be displaced by fire. I might be displaced by a flood or other things where I might have to go back to that shelter, and I don't want to be treated the way I was before. And thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I appreciate you.
Thank you for being with us. And we have Jeremy Creasy with us.
Hello, Chair Hausman and members of the housing community. My name is Jeremy Creasy, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do. This is a quote from Steve Jobs. And if you don't know who Steve Jobs is, you are probably using one of the pieces of technology he has created by being a co-founder of Apple. I think we can change the world, or at least make a big difference in it or impact it. When I was 17, I ended up having a TBI, and because of it, I became epileptic, disabled, and later had mental health issues because of it. I tried to live just a pretty basic, normal life, proceeded to go through college and work, but I was overrun with the stress and having stress-induced seizures. I led trying to deal with that stress by dealing with it, by dealing with addiction. Through all that process of coping, now I am 4 years sober. I soon realized I must be crazy to keep getting back up after all the curveballs life threw at me. I saw a lot of people give up, but I knew anyone can make a difference if they want to and have something to fight for. This is why, me personally, I kept getting up, because I realized there must be more out there to fight for, rather deciding what factors or situations you are in. I've lived in many different types of housing situations, whether it's homelessness, sober housing, GRH, or housing supports as they're called now, to 90-day programs, to finally reaching one of my goals of being independent and living in my own apartment. And that's a huge step for a lot of people from being homelessness. That's a huge end goal. And some people have bigger goals from that. How I got involved with ARC and Homes for All was through my caseworker. She looked at me and saw me developing as a young man, and she realized I could do more. So she asked me, Jeremy, what do you want to do today? I said, I don't know, but there's got to be more out there for me. So she said, let's volunteer. I was like, all right, get involved in the community. Sounds great. So I ended up volunteering at ARC, and my manager to this day saw potential in me. And so she offered me a job. I later applied, and I'm still holding down that job. I was living in a group home at that time, and after all these people saw this potential in me, I realized I wanted more for myself too. So I reached out to the housing services of ARC, and I started my way to get more independent from this group home. But there's one big thing holding me back from that process or being there. It was the deposit on the apartment. And probably the best thing that happened to me and the worst thing for a lot of other people was COVID-19. I ended up getting a stimulus check, and I put all of it towards the deposit on my apartment, which I am now maintaining, holding down a job and living a very good life. Housing services have helped me grow into the strong, confident, independent person that you see in front of you right now. And I'm going to college at Purdue University, working and still active in my community. These housing services were there for me when I had no one to turn to and had no place to go. And I was about to pretty much give up on myself and my hopes and my dreams, the things over a lot of time I was fighting for. Housing services gave me hope when I pretty much didn't have hope. They were the light at the tunnel that you look down and you see a glimmer of it. My dreams and hopes now are to finish school, have a family, and through entrepreneurship and my business management, finishing that degree is to own a business. Pretty lofty goals for someone that was once homeless. You know, you think about the transition of people growing from those places. Those dreams seem way out there and they feel unattainable. It is important to give people a chance, even if they don't see potential in themselves. Other people, like a caseworker, manager, pretty much anybody, or services like housing, may see that potential. They can help them achieve their hopes and dreams and goals and get them to be competent or even crazy, as Steve Jobs says, enough to start making their own change. And this is exactly what happened to me. I now never give up, and if I fail, I'll keep trying and keep going to get back up and continue to pursue my hopes and dreams. These services gave a disabled mental health addict a chance. Why not another person? Whatever labels, circumstances they have, they should at least be given one small chance to fight for their hopes and dreams. If it includes housing, and that potential housing service could help them achieve these dreams. You know, housing is one of those things that if you have something to go back to, relax and reflect on your day, what you could do better that next day can help you achieve those goals. Because in reality, if you compare yourself to some other person, that puts stress on you. But in reality, the battle is you versus you. How can you get better the next day? If you can get in that mindset, you can achieve anything. Do you have hopes and dreams? I'm 29 and I still do. I have a lot of them. Are they for yourself, your kids, your grandkids? Another one of my hopes and dreams is to inspire others to never give up on themselves and their hopes and dreams. Because in reality, what do you have to live for if you don't have hopes and dreams? I personally, all of you, hope you never give up on your hopes and dreams, no matter how big or small they are, or maybe even crazy they sound, because if you keep fighting to achieve them, nothing can stop you. And that's the reality of it. Nothing can stop you, even if you have that small glimmer of hope inside you. That's the one thing you can keep fighting for, and that will drive you to achieve them.
Thank you very much.
And I hope you guys have a great rest of your day.
Thank you very much, Mr. Creasy, for sharing Mr. Creasy and I are pledged to one another that we won't give up. Linda Soderstrom is next.
Good morning, Chair Hausman and committee members. I was invited here today to share with you my lived experience, which was that in 2015, I lived-
And if you will identify yourself for the record, please.
I am so, so sorry. My name is Linda Soderstrom. I do live between Rochester and Winona in rural Minnesota at this time. The reason I come here today is that I wanted to let you know that I lived at Crossroads at Penn in 2015. And some of you have heard about that displacement. It was a mass displacement of 2,350 people when a new owner came in to upscale the building and reposition it in the marketplace. You can decorate a property, but you cannot redo a population. Human beings were impacted greatly, and some of my friends from Crossroads are still looking for their second, third, fourth, even one is looking for a fifth apartment since that displacement. Whole communities are impacted. School children by the hundreds lose their cohort and lose their progress. And that is why I wanted to ask that as part of the Homes for All continuum, that we look at preservation of existing properties. Some of the most affordable properties in this entire country have already been built, and to preserve those as affordable for communities without disrupting community is a very good goal, I think, and hopefully we can all work together in that way. The impact for me was that I moved a mile away, and though I do have a Section 8 voucher that ports with me wherever I needed to go in the nation, I was displaced again on the first day of the 24th month. So I was approaching my 70s and displaced twice in 2 years' time, had to leave the Twin Cities because I was priced out, and the impact upon me were upon my health, upon my finances, and upon my standing in the community. I am currently with a group called Freedom from the Streets, No More Streets, and I'm also on the board of the Housing Justice Center. And I try to advocate with and for others. As Jeremy shared, the ability to be on Zoom with you today is actually a positive that's coming out of the COVID. And because I live 135 miles away, I could only have chosen to be on those two boards, but now I can continue with some of the other groups I advocate for. So thank you so much for your time today. And if you have any questions, we are all available to answer those. Thank you so kindly.
Thank you very much. And we have Natipedad Seatbelt with us.
Good morning, Chair Hausman and committee members. It's really great to be here and see some familiar faces. Some of the representatives that I know personally. I am the current president of Park Plaza Cooperative and have been since 2010. We are a manufactured home community that was given the opportunity to purchase our community. When I came home from work one day, we had a letter in our mail. It said, I am selling my community and would like to offer it up to you. I sat back and said to myself, oh my goodness, what am I going to do with a house of 20 years worth of stuff at that time, making $21,000 a year and nowhere to go. My house was old and there was nowhere it was going to go. So I cried for a few days and thought, okay, what's my next step? North Country Foundation sent us a letter and then said, we would like to help you purchase your community. And I was like, oh my goodness, how are we going to do that? You know, ordinary people every day going to purchase a big community. Take in mind that growing up, my father was in the military. We moved a lot. And when I was a kid, we lived in the car on the beach in California and went to school coming out of a car. We didn't always get new clothes. We didn't have food. So I have been on all spectrums of being very poor, in the middle, and being extremely rich. So I thought, we got to do this. We have to purchase our community. It's in the heart of Fridley, 5 miles from everything, right next door to Friendly Chevrolet, and 2 miles from the train station and 2 miles from either freeway. Anybody would pick us up because that would be a great opportunity for some more apartment complexes, or Friendly Chev might have wanted to purchase it at the time. We had a meeting after meeting. We finally said yes, and we became a community with the opportunity to purchase. Also keep in mind that this same owner also owned Lowry Grove. And if anybody's read the story, Lowry Grove was one of those big stories in the paper and on TV that was a community that was not going to be sold to the people. Everyone was displaced, all levels of families, people who had lived there forever, with two suicides during that process. And it was a very sad time for many. We still don't know where some of the families wound up. And the community was shut down, and they did not have the opportunity to purchase. So now we hear that it's turning back into another manufactured home community, which is very sad, but at a very expensive level of housing. So we are working really hard to get the opportunity to purchase bill pushed through this year. We've been working on it 4 years. We've changed some language, and with the help of some great sponsors, co-sponsors, and authors, we are looking forward to the opportunity, so to speak, to be able to pass this law. Keep it in mind that the moratorium at some point will stop. A lot of these communities, which we have over 900 in our state, will have lots of families that will be evicted. That will also then turn on to the owners of these communities, whether they're big owners from different states or their ma and pa. How will they be able to afford to pay their mortgages? Well, then that's going to give them the opportunity to sell. And of course, we would like for them to be able to offer that up to the communities. Being a co-op in the state of Minnesota has given us the opportunity to take control of our financials, take control of keeping our rents down, keeping everybody safe, stable, healthy, and working together as a community. I always wanted to go back to 1960 when you could knock on your neighbor's door and say, can I have some eggs or sugar, or do you want to babysit my kids, right? Here we are in the 20th century, living in a small little community of a little over 200 families, members. I think we have 81 total families right now. And we do that every day. We help each other. We shovel, we babysit, we get food for each other and stuff. And we're in 1960, back in the 20th century, right? Which is the best thing ever. But we can't do that if we don't have the opportunity to purchase for all the communities across the state. We need the chance to be able to do that and give them the chance to take control of their land and marry it to their homes so that they don't ever get displaced again. You can't take your home anywhere if it's old. In fact, you can't even take it anywhere if it's new, because you're not always going to be able to do that. So I would like to see us work really, really hard together. State Representative Michael Howard knows about this very well. To try and get this bill passed this year and give us the chance to spread the love of becoming a co-op and taking control of ourselves and not have someone over us raising the rent every 6 months. One good example is a community sold. The next morning, the rent went up $100. If you're on a fixed income, how can you afford an extra $100? You're not going to be able to do that. You'll be on the streets. And it doesn't matter how old you are or how many people are in your home, you'll be on the streets at $100 extra. Even 20, some people are struggling with $20. So our story is big, large, and in charge. So please help us. And thank you so very much for having us today.
Thank you very much. So members, we've heard four stories. The complexity of, as people struggle in their lives, to continue to have a safe place to sleep at night. And the stories, I think, have helped us understand that. And we are going to conclude with Chad Adams, who is a Homes for All co-chair. Mr. Adams.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chad Adams, and I am the CEO of the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership with offices in Slayton and Mankato, Minnesota. I've been the CEO for Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership for 18 months, but I previously served in local government management as a city administrator and manager for 20 years prior to this position, most recently as a city manager of Albert Lea, where I advanced a number of housing initiatives throughout Southeast Minnesota and in Albert Lea. Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership promotes and delivers a high quality comprehensive menu of services, and our goal is to support preservation, stability, and economic development across 30 counties in southwestern and south central Minnesota. And this past fall, I was also elected as a co-chair of the Homes for All Coalition. Like many issues, as Pastor Sue indicated, working to solve Minnesota's affordable housing crisis is complex, but a safe, affordable, and accessible home is a necessary foundation if we want to have a better education outcomes for our children, healthcare that has meaningful long-term benefits, and economic stability for our communities. For these reasons, we are also advocating for more housing opportunities in Minnesota. Homes for All's agenda is also focused on creating and preserving more homes. We are very grateful for the passage of the bonding bill this last fall, but we need consistent state financial investments. As with every legislative session, we remain committed in 2021 to seek bonding funds for affordable housing. We also see changes to the 4D tax classification rate as helpful to preserving naturally occurring affordable housing, along with required 30-year minimum terms in exchange for state financial investments and developments. And as you heard from Linda, displacement has lasting consequences for households, schools, communities, and the economy. Minnesota has so much work to do in order to provide more opportunities for ownership and wealth building to lower income, but financially ready households, especially for our Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. This is why we are advocating for the opportunity for residents of manufactured home parks to purchase the land to save this crucial affordable housing around the state, as well as secure funding through the capture of the mortgage and registry deed tax to support affordable home ownership. Additionally, it's also important that I note that the coalition's commitment to being responsive to emergencies related to the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly around gap funding to help mortgage holders struggling and to prevent a wave of life-altering evictions from happening. Before I close, I'd like to take just a few seconds to acknowledge the hard work that so many coalition members put into advancing our collective work. We have a passionate people and organization supporting this important work throughout the state. The coronavirus pandemic has added an additional layer of stress to all of our member organizations, especially those on the ground that were already stretched thin. To all of the Homes for All members out there working double time and still showing up to advocate, thank you. I also want to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today. We look forward to working with you all, and we are very happy to answer any questions you may have.
And as I understand, you represent 290 endorsing organizations. Is that correct?
Correct. Over 270 endorsing organizations throughout the entirety of the state.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wirth, do we have questions for Homes for All?
Representative Howard has a question.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's a bit of a comment, and mainly to thank the testifiers and to comment just on the power of advocacy. And specifically, I want to thank Linda. It's really good to see you. I don't think I would be here sitting in this committee if not for Linda. The story that she mentioned happened in at Crossroads in my community in Richfield. At that time, I was on the city council, had only been there a couple months when this trauma happened to our community. And in government, in city government, state government, we were all caught flat-footed at this new, this emerging trend in the market where speculators really were coming, buying up these facilities and mass displacements were happening. We had over 100 children in Richfield leave our schools because of this. 38 of those kids experienced homelessness as a result of this mass displacement. And due to the advocacy of Linda and others, they've worked really hard to raise the profile of the importance of preservation. And I just want to share that as we come out of this pandemic, I am deeply concerned about what's going to happen in the market to our naturally occurring affordable housing. I think we've seen in previous economic downturns, whether it be through the home foreclosure crisis or others, when the market is in upheaval, too often wealthy conglomerates really are able to capitalize on this to the harm of our communities. And so I just wanted to thank Linda for being here and for her advocacy and for the advocacy of everyone for Homes for All. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Worth, any others?
Representative Ryer has a question.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted really to make a comment as well, specifically to thank Ms. Thomas, Mr. Creasy, Ms. Soderstrom, and Ms. Seafeld. To me, what your testimony has done is help us keep front and center in our minds that there is not one size fits all for solutions, that if we are looking at a way to address housing issues and solve homelessness as well and prevent it, we need to be thinking about individual stories like yours. And when people will come forward as you have done and share your experiences with us, it helps us move forward and know some examples and the life impact that our work has. I'm a first-time legislator, and so I am especially grateful and wanted to thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Worth, others?
Representative Tice has a question.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank everyone for the wonderful testimonials you give. It really is encouraging. And I have been very interested in making sure that we keep homes in the market affordable. Being in building remodeling, I understand how that rollover happens, but I also see the need for keeping it where it is. So I'm very committed to making sure that we keep things, housing where it is, and really appreciate your efforts in keeping us aware of it, but also look forward to working with any legislation that we can do. So thank you very much. It's been very inspiring this morning listening to everyone and bringing forward what we need to be focusing on.
Thank you. Mr. Worth, others?
Madam Chair, there are no other questions at this
time. Okay. Thank you very much to all the testifiers, to Homes for All, and to members for your participation. The challenge is great, but we have wonderful partners, and we're going to hear from two of them today. We're not in this alone, and there's a lot of good work going on out there. And we will first have a presentation from Ann Mavity with the Minnesota Housing Partnership. Ms. Mavity, welcome to the committee. And please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you so much. Yes, so my name is Ann Mavity. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. And I'm also here on the line is Libby Murphy. She is our deputy policy director. And if you haven't met her yet, you will. She leads our work at the Capitol. And all of us are here to be a resource for all of you as you are looking at and understanding the variety of policy proposals that will come before this committee this year. So today I'm hoping to provide you an understanding of affordable housing broadly, some of the terms that you're going to be hearing over and over and over, and talk a little bit about some of these housing trends. I also just wanted to say that I want to also thank the Homes for All speakers in really grounding us in the reality of these housing challenges. And it's a reminder that the work of this committee really has such dramatic impacts on the lives of real people in your districts and around the state. So let's jump to the presentation. The first couple slides, I'll just cruise through a little bit. Minnesota Housing Partnership, as many of you know, we've been around for about 30 years and work to really convene and guide and help shape the work of housing stakeholders in Minnesota and beyond. So we are rooted in Minnesota. Oh, and Owen, by the way, I'm just going to cruise through these. You can keep. So yeah, we are rooted in Minnesota and provide technical assistance to rural communities and Native communities all around Minnesota and actually all around the country. We work nationwide. And I'm actually delighted to share that just last week we received notice of our largest grant to date from HUD, $2.4 million. Dollars to continue to serve Minnesota's rural communities and tribes, as well as work around the country. In addition to that work, we also produce research that makes the case for investing in affordable housing. In addition to that, and I'll be talking about some of that research as well as other people's research and bringing all that together to help inform your decisions. And then we also advance policy solutions and investments in affordable housing. So one of those examples of a sort of solution-oriented approach that we've done is local housing trust funds. So we use some of our federal funding to help research and create a manual for local communities in Minnesota to help establish local housing trust funds. And now we're working with a number of them around the state to establish their own local housing trust funds locally. And we're happy to connect you with some of your communities that are doing that if you're interested. So, and you can get that manual off our website. I'll also note that every biennium we create a state of the state of housing report. That report will be released in several weeks, and we'll make sure that all of you get it, and that will provide both legislative district housing fact sheets as well as county fact sheets as well. So why does housing matter? You know, when I heard all of your introductions last Tuesday, one of the things that was really meaningful to me was as each of you introduced yourself, you talked about your housing story. We all have it. And whether that's a lovely and nostalgic sort of memories about a stable home and a supportive community, or if it's a dramatic story of housing instability or through refugee camps, either way, whatever path has led you here, all of us understand that critical importance of home. And housing does matter. It impacts every part of our lives, from workers to seniors, our children. We talk a lot about how important it is as a stable platform for children to learn and thrive and grow in a healthy way. You know that as well as I. So let's talk a little bit about some of the terms that you'll be using along the way as you are considering all these housing proposals that are coming before you. So the first thing is, what does that mean when we say affordable housing? And frankly, there's not a single definition, but the common definition is talking about it as paying no more than 30% of your gross income on housing. So that is supposed to leave you enough money for other needs you might have, getting medicine or food or transportation. But clearly that's not pure, because 30% of a low-wage worker salary, maybe $15,000 a year, that only leaves you $10,000 for the whole year for everything, whereas 30% of $100,000 leaves you a whole lot more expendable income. And so it obviously impacts lower income folks more. So some other terms that we talk about then are that you'll hear a lot about is cost burden. And so I just want to review that with you about what does that mean. So when we talk about cost burden, that means you're paying more than 30% of your income for housing. A severe cost burden means that you're paying more than half your income for housing. Other terms you'll hear a lot is extremely low income, which typically means those households making 30% AMI and below. Now for the Twin Cities, what is AMI? The area median income really means that middle income. So half the folks are making above it, half are making less. In the Twin Cities area, that has just gone beyond $100,000 a year. It's easy to do the math. 30% is generally $30,000. But you'll hear a lot about area median income. It's really important to contextualize that when you hear it, because every community's median income really impacts sort of how that housing, access to housing impacts them locally. And you know that. So let's talk about why housing is so unaffordable. Basically, wages aren't keeping up with housing costs. Almost all the top in-demand jobs that we're seeing that are growing, most of them don't pay enough to afford a two-bedroom apartment. And Minnesota's housing crisis is hitting the hardest for these low-wage workers, who are the backbone of our communities, right? And those jobs that have projected growth, like home health aides, the folks that are taking care of my mom or delivering all this food to our houses these days, those wages don't make enough to pay the rent. So wages just simply aren't keeping up. And what does that mean? on the next slide, what that means is that more than 25% of Minnesota households are paying more than they can afford for housing. That's both renter and homeowners. And that was before the pandemic and economic shutdowns. So again, it makes it so much harder to afford these other necessities that we all need to thrive: food, clothing, transportation, medical care. And it's important to note that this is across the state. So as you look at the renter cost burden, some of the worst cost burdens are in north and northeast, north central parts of the state. I'll also note that the Fargo-Moorhead, or Moorhead-Fargo, as Pastor Sue was mentioning earlier today, has the highest percent of renter cost burden at 56%. That means that more than half of all the renters in that area are paying too much for their housing and leaving them stressed. And I'll note that 97%, nearly every county in Minnesota, has more than a third of its renters paying more than they can afford for rent. Now, we can't talk about this without understanding that everything we do in housing has been informed by decades and decades of racist housing policies. And so when we look at the cost burden, we see here in this slide that BIPOC households, Black, Indigenous, people of color, they experience more cost burdens than white households throughout the state, and they're more likely to pay too much for their housing. Now, COVID has been exacerbating these trends, especially for our lowest wage workers. Yeah, what this slide is talking about is, and this is before, some of our data is a little complicated because we are seeing the positive and impactful outcomes that rental assistance and some of these federal unemployment dollars have had. But without that kind of support, this chart shows that as expired federal unemployment insurance payments, we're leaving low-wage workers with almost no money to pay rent or no money for the rest of their lives after rent was paid. So again, back to racial disparities. One of the things we know is that decades and centuries of methodical and intentional racist housing policies have resulted in unequal housing opportunities and the outcomes we see today. So for example, if you're a person of color, you're half as likely to be a homeowner. You're 2.5 times as likely to be severely cost burdened, paying more than you can afford. And you're more than 6 times more likely to experience homelessness. So what we like to say is that we need to have the same intention and strategy and method that these policies were created out of. We need to use that same level of intention to remove these embedded discriminatory barriers. So we're going to be hearing a lot about the need for housing assistance. I think you heard on Tuesday from Minnesota Housing how the $100 million in rental assistance was spent on low-income renters and homeowners who were unable to pay their housing costs. It was oversubscribed. And we know that rental loss impacts housing providers as well. Right now in Minnesota, the total rental income losses through mid-2021 or so are estimated anywhere between, in a best-case scenario, $200 million, and in a worst-case scenario, up to $400 million. And these property owners are small business owners who need their income, their rental income, to pay their own costs, the debt on the property, taxes, et cetera. So traditionally, the federal government has helped get these rents paid through the Housing Choice Voucher Program. And that has helped to bridge the gap between the wages that we saw earlier that aren't keeping up with housing costs. But the problem is that even while our population has been growing, the actual number of vouchers funded has been reduced in Minnesota and across the country. So what does that mean? That means that, and you'll see this in the next slide, that now nearly 4 out of 5 households that are eligible to receive rental assistance don't get it. Yeah, we used to say 3 out of 4, but it's been getting worse. And you're seeing this in the waiting list that lasts for years. Maybe you recall a couple years back when Met Council opened its waiting list for its new voucher applications. They have 600 vouchers, by the way, all of which are currently in use, right? It's only the annual turnover that allows them to issue new vouchers. 36,000 people applied for those. So what's interesting and notable on this slide is that
the second half of that slide, by the way, I think we have to always emphasize, everyone gets some assistance. We get it if you own a home.
Thank you.
Just wanted to be sure we underscore that.
Well, that is absolutely right. That there is a narrative out there that somehow that we are paying so much money for low-income households and housing. But in fact, homeowners receive more subsidies through the mortgage interest deduction than low-income households do. And the next slide, just briefly, just broadly, it's a little bit of a dated slide, but what this is showing you is the lower incomes are the dark blue. This is the federal money spent on housing assistance. And the light blue on the right-hand side is showing you how much money is spent, typically through the mortgage interest deduction tax, on upper-income households. So this idea about who is benefiting from our housing assistance, I think, needs to be reexamined. So let's talk briefly about evictions. So this issue of rental assistance becomes increasingly urgent during these times with COVID and the economic shutdown. And I just want to note, today's Star Tribune business page, if you haven't seen it, has a great article on the pace of rental payments, which tells an interesting story of how rental assistance is in fact working and it's helping to keep people housed. So HUD and the Census Department started this survey called the Pulse Survey that has been tracking rental payments and rental non-payments through the COVID. And it's indicated that 40% of Minnesota adults are in households that weren't current on rent or mortgage. Now, that could be as many as 50 to 75,000 households in Minnesota that could be subject to eviction once the moratorium is lifted, just for non-payment. And that's versus 10 to 12,000 a year. However, the rental assistance is working and it's going a long way to mitigate those numbers. And as you know, we now have $375 million in rental assistance that's coming into Minnesota from the federal government's Emergency Relief Act. So hopefully that'll go a long way, but it's in mitigating evictions, but it's an important takeaway in how important rental assistance is and how effective it is. So let's talk about production here. The next couple slides I'm going to go through were produced by Minnesota Housing, and maybe you've seen them, as part of the Governor's Housing Task Force a couple years ago. And they help explain why there's such a mismatch between the need and demand for affordable housing and the supply of it. So the first one, the first one here is shows that about 8,800 units were produced in a single year. I think that's about 2017. And each color on this chart represents an income target. Green is the lowest income and dark blue is the highest income. And of the total units produced by the market, the current distribution, as shown in dark blue, the vast majority of all units were for renters making 80% or more of the area median income, the highest income renters. And if you look really closely at that top bar, the green line on the left-hand side represents about 100 units of housing that was affordable to people at the lowest income, at 30% below, you know, the folks giving us our coffee and taking care of our kids. So you can see that the market is just not producing units that are affordable to minimum wage and low wage workers. So when you look at the lower bar on what was needed there, if just to keep up with population growth, what we should be producing every year is about 2,400 new units for our lowest income households, if we're just trying to keep up with population growth, but only 100 were produced. So this has happened year over year over year for decades. So in the next slide, you can see that what has happened is that, you know, there's about 179 renter households in Minnesota that are at this lowest income, 30%. So correspondingly, you would hope to see the same number of housing units available to them and affordable to them. But instead, there's only 114,000 units that are priced affordably for these households, which leaves a supply gap of 65,000 units. So think about that. That's what we're trying to build toward, that 65 units. But worse is that nearly half of the 14,000 units that we have are actually occupied by higher income households. That's why low income households are so cost burdened. So when we look at the future supply and the needs that we have. This slide shows that green, straight green line across is indicating the new housing that's needed just for year over year population growth. But it's also showing us that that recession, that 10 years from about 2006 to 2016, production plummeted dramatically, which means it needs to accelerate dramatically over the next several years to catch up, to fill the gap of that production shortage when we're recovering from the recession. And really, it's going to take about 20 years to fully correct from that economic challenge. So we don't fully know what the challenges we're now in and will result in, but we're hopeful that housing production continues actually now at a steady pace, and that's good. It's what we want to see, and it's why we need continued investments. So I wanted to touch briefly then on NOAA and the loss of existing housing, because as the market produces housing itself that has been affordable, and you hear this term a lot, NOAA, naturally occurring affordable housing, and that just means that it's market housing. It doesn't have any public funding in it. And yet, remember, public funding often helps restrict rent increases and keeps it affordable. These are typically what we call Class C properties. They're not fancy or anything like that. And by the way, MHP has lots of reports on this on our...
And our next speaker is going to speak.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. So so just to get some of those like basic facts, it costs less to preserve housing than produce it. It leverages the private marketplace. And as Representative Howard was talking about, it reduces displacement and keeps more communities more stable. On the next one, I'll just note, we have just produced a report on Greater Minnesota, NOAA, so really looking at that private sector market. And one of the things that we're really seeing, this is a heat map of where those NOAA concentrations are. And it's important because that's where we may be threatened with losing affordabilities. And so I know, like, Representative Tice, you're probably noticing St. Cloud is hopping out at us for that. And we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to maintain affordabilities. So housing in rural Minnesota in general, it is at risk. USDA, the federal government, has had this Section 515 program, and Minnesota was very aggressive 40 years ago in using that program, but it now means that all of those are coming due, and we are at risk of losing them. So when you look at the next slide, which really shows in where in rural Minnesota, where some of these housing Section 515 projects are, Wright County, Stearns County, Rice County, these are areas that we are really paying a lot of attention to make sure that we don't lose affordability and that we can maintain and preserve those. So I'll just conclude by saying we have solutions. You heard the Homes for All agenda. That helps provide a roadmap to what you can do, what local governments, counties can do, all of that. So there are production solutions, there are preservation solutions, there are solutions to address housing instability and improving access, and of course, these immediate COVID timely solutions, looking at these emergency housing assistance, purchase and acquisition strategies, et cetera. Over the next coming weeks and months, we're happy to talk with you individually about each of these as you have questions and testify on specific proposals. So I know I took up a lot of time. I hope that was helpful, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Worth, do we have questions for Ms. Mafferty?
We have no member questions at this time.
Okay, we'll give them a minute just in case hands haven't gone up. Thank you very much. Did we find one?
Madam Chair, Representative Gomez has a question.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks so much to all the testifiers and to Ms. Mafferty for this information. I just, serve on the taxes committees, the two of them, and have been doing that for the last couple of years. And I just wanted to highlight the information that Ann shared about the mortgage interest deduction. So in the 2019 tax bill, in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, the Trump tax bill, one of the things that they did is they doubled the standard deduction. So like kind of regular people right? You take that amount off the top. I can't remember. I feel like I don't remember the figures, but it went from like 7,000 per person to 14,000 per person or something along these lines. And so that means that fewer and fewer people are doing itemized deductions on their taxes, and certainly fewer and fewer people who are at the lower income levels are deducting than ever, because in 2019 in our tax bill, we conformed with that provision of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So that means that in Minnesota now, you also have a higher base level standard deduction for all taxpayers off the top. And so, so what that means, right, is that fewer and fewer people, as I said, are doing individual deductions. And just the cost, real quick, for the mortgage interest deduction, this is from the tax expenditure budget that the Department of Revenue puts out every 2 years. So in 2020, $83.4 million goes up kind of a little bit, you know, by 2023, it's $97.3 million. Now, these dollars are disproportionately going to the wealthiest Minnesotans who frankly need the least help in staying in their homes. But we have to think about this $97 million a year as money that's going, that is public dollars flowing into tax, into housing. And in this case, what it's flowing into housing to do is to uphold the deepest racial home ownership gap in the country. So our policy directly, right, our $100 million a year is going to support the status quo in our home ownership reality. And so I just wanted to highlight that because—
Okay, and then and we can get back to that too after our third speaker.
If I could just finish my pitch, I have—
Yeah, just one. Very, very quickly.
Yep, I'm just switching up. So when we talk about an unprecedented level of housing infrastructure bonds this year being $125 million, which we're thrilled about, we need to think about the fact that we're spending $100 million a year also. When this committee got a $20 million target in 19, we're spending $100 million a year on this mortgage interest deduction, which is for the wealthiest Minnesotans. Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for going long.
Yeah, thank you very much. We have a last item on the agenda is testimony from Alan Arthur with Aon. We heard from Ann Navity that building new is expensive, finding and saving naturally occurring affordable housing is less expensive. And Mr. Arthur has become an expert at that and has done so much good work that I'm happy to welcome him to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hausman, committee members. I'm Alan Arthur, and I'm the president and CEO of Aon. We're a nonprofit affordable housing developer, owner, and manager. We have 5,660 affordable apartments across the Twin Cities. And I'm not sure I'm an expert at anything, really, frankly. But I have been doing this for a little while, for about 50 years. So in the housing, real estate, construction, et cetera, business. So I've been around a little while. It's really hard to follow the folks we've had testify today, Tyra and Jeremy and Linda and Natividad and all the technical expertise that that Ann brought to the table. But I'll talk a little bit about NOAA. You know, sometimes in life, everything seems like a crisis. This may be one of those times. It helps me at least, to take a step back and say, what are my values? What are my priorities? What's important to me in my life, my family, and my neighborhood and community? For human beings, you know, the top of that list is air. It's kind of important for us. Water, food, home is right up there. You know, I'm lucky. I'm still eating three meals a day. I'm one of the lucky ones. But home is right up there. It's critical in our lives, that feeling of safety and security when we walk in through that door after a hard day's work, where we connect with people, our families that we care about, friends, connect within the community, a place that we make ours, we take responsibility for. For many in our community, as Ann and others have pointed out, for social, economic, and policy reasons, and long-term ones, by the way, 30, 40 years of them, homelessness is about to double. It may triple. That was going to be true before COVID-19. A key problem is, as others have said, the significant ongoing loss of affordable housing, including the NOAAs that have been talked about, but also including manufactured home parks that Natividad and others talked about. You know, a recent real estate report just came out this week, actually, predicts increasing demand from local and national investors buying properties, including those NOAAs, including manufactured home parks, and pushing rents higher. That's why they're buying them. That's their primary goal. That's what the marketplace does. There are many, many contributing factors to these affordable housing problems we face, but it's fundamentally an economic equity issue. More and more of our neighbors have insufficient resources to capitalize and recapitalize housing in the marketplace. So, you know, from a comparison standpoint, air is being sucked out of the lives of our families and individuals. The lake is drying up. There's less and less food on the tables. Each year, the state of Minnesota annually loses more affordable housing units than we create. And that's been true for quite a number of years. It's further and further out of reach. And of course, it's logical that that's unsustainable for the families and individuals and institutions, our communities, our businesses who rely on those minimum wage, those low wage service workers to survive. You'll have already heard and you'll continue to hear about a lot of proposed programs and initiatives. And I'm here to tell you that there's not a single one that isn't logical or useful. The need and demand are that great. Whether it's a NOAA funding bill, the 4D tax program proposals, significant rent support and assistance proposals, both near-term rental assistance as well as long-term program proposals, all of them are going to be necessary to meet the challenge we face. We need to both create and preserve affordable housing, but preserving is half or less as expensive as creating new. In the past 3 years, AON has rescued 3,000 affordable NOAA units from facing the path of rapidly increasing rents and family dislocation that Representative Howard and others have talked about. AON continues to work with those existing properties on longer-term plans to not only try to keep them affordable, but improve them from a physical and capital standpoint. When we step into these NOAA properties, saving them from an unfettered marketplace, many, perhaps most of the residents who are there when we step in are already paying 50%, not the 30% rule of thumb that Ann talked about, but they're already paying 50% of their meager income for their housing. So any kind of rent increase is crushing, untenable, not going to work. That's why Linda, when she talked about so many of these families being displaced and displaced again and displaced again, that's what's happening. Even 100, 150 or 200 increase in rent is going to displace somebody who's already paying 50%. So Ann and other nonprofits and all the folks you heard here today and our communities themselves need a public that supports affordable homes for our people. And of course, that includes you. I'm happy to answer any questions that I can answer.
So the point is you will find a property and with your own finances, save it, because if another developer comes along, they may renovate and raise rents and displace people who are currently living there. That's what's happening.
It's happening over and over again. And just to be clear, when I say our own money, we don't have free money in our pockets. It's using the really low interest rates that are out there in the world today, as well as some equity investors who expect a lower return, a really way lower return, rather than the marketplace's 10 to 15 to 20% requirement or expectations for return on equity. We're working with people, individuals who might expect as little as a 2% return, and local institutions and foundations who might only expect a 5% return or 7% return. And just to be clear, for every percent difference in return that one of our partners or equity investors expects, it means a $40 to $50 difference in rent. So 7% return expectation is $150 maybe difference in rent than a 4%. Return expectations. So that's why we are trying to work with so many partners to get cheaper money into this arena so that we can have a chance of preserving this housing if we can.
And our motivation to be a partner with you in this work is, for us, there's a cost to homelessness. And I think Utah was maybe one of the first states to recognize that. They were spending more money on homelessness than they were on creating housing. So that's the motivation for state government.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Mr. Worth, do we have questions?
There are no questions in the queue at this time.
We'll give a few minutes.
Representative Ryer has a question.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask a newcomer question. I am I support everything I'm hearing about what you're saying about Aon, but I am not understanding how it all works and exactly what you do and how it fits together. And I'm wondering if I could just get a primer on that. Thank you.
Mr. Arthur.
Sure, Chair Hausman, Representative Ryer. Basically, we're a nonprofit organization. We find out that a property is going to be sold. For example, Representative Howard was part of letting us know about a property in Richfield in 2017 that was going to be sold. And we only had 3 days to talk to the owner and try to buy it. If it had been sold in the marketplace, it was going to look exactly like the Crossroads property that Linda talked about. People were almost all the residents were going to be displaced. It was going to be lipstick was going to be put on the project, and rents were going to be raised $200, $300, $400. And all the people, all 422 households were going to have to move. So we had 3 days to try to cajole the seller to sell to us instead of the person he had been negotiating with for 8 months. And we were very, very fortunate in that situation. The seller was out of Denver, and I happened to personally know the seller. If that had not been true, those 422 families would have been displaced. And it still is hard to get that seller to change and sell to us instead of just by coincidence, I happen to know the seller. So what we do is we put together a proposal to purchase the property at a certain price, got to be market, somewhere close to market, or the sellers won't sell to us. And then we go out there and we seek investor partners who expect a lower return instead of the return of 10% or 15% or 20%. We find partners who only expect 5 or 6 or 7% or less. And if that's the case, and if we can get the 4D, because our goal is to keep the rents down below a certain level. So along with the cheaper money from the expectations returns and the 4D tax breaks that we can get, if we work with, for example, in this case was the city of Richfield, then we can run the property at a cheaper than the private investor, private owner or buyer would have run it at, and allows us to not make those huge rent increases. Sometimes we even have to raise rents $50 or $75 to make it work, but not $150, not $250, not $350. And so that 4D plus the cheaper equity money in today's current interest rates allow us to keep the rents $150, $250, $350 lower than they would otherwise be if it was sold into the marketplace. So that's basically how it works on these NOAs.
And what I recall you're saying at one point is the private developer might be able to pay cash, you can't pay cash. So that's the challenge you have in saving the property.
Yeah, we have lots of challenges, but that's one of them,
Now, I seem to recall in the last conversation I had with you that you said you're beginning to see some change, that some of the investors are beginning to understand we have to figure out how to save these properties and keep the rents low, that you were seeing a shift.
Yeah, I think we have more and more, institutions, both cities, communities, as well as foundations, and others that understand that we have to come up with a cheaper capital to preserve these. You know, the interesting thing is that some people think I'm beating up on the private marketplace, and there are some times when I do, but truthfully, they're doing what they do. They're doing what they do. And these properties do need capital. These are 30 or 40 or 50 year old properties that do need capital improvements. And so somebody has to put capital into them. We're still, challenged. Linda and I just had an exchange a few months ago about this. We're still working hard to try to get capital into some of these ones that we've already bought because they need the improvements. And we put quite a bit of money into many of them, but we still have more to go. So it's not about beating up in the marketplace. It's about understanding the reality of the marketplace and doing what we need to do to fix those problems that were talked about earlier in the conversation, that we have this thing we're facing that we need to fix.
Representative Ryer, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick one. So then, Mr. Arthur, the your organization is the property manager then, and you take on the ongoing responsibility?
Yes, we're the owner. Controlling manager really is the better way to say it. We are the controlling partner because we do have those partners, whether, you know, in some ways the mortgage lender is a partner too. We have others that we owe, have expectations we have to meet, and we're the owner and manager of those long-term, correct? So those 5,660 apartments that I talked about that we own them like you own your home, and yet you still own a mortgage. We owe a mortgage, and we owe investors returns of some kind, hopefully a lower returns than normal, but yes. And we're the responsible party for running them. That's right.
Mr. Worth, other questions?
Representative Howard has a question.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Arthur, you alluded to this, I think, a little bit about some reports about what folks might expect in the market related to COVID. I'm concerned that, you know, we saw a home foreclosure crisis a decade ago. I'm concerned we're going to see defaults and foreclosures in some of these larger, you know, Class C NOAA properties, and that those could be ripe for investors to come in. And so I'm wondering if you'd comment on that. And then additionally, thank you for highlighting the story at Seasons Park. It was just the outcome difference was enormous for a community. That saved the homes of over 300 kids in Richfield. And what I wanted to see if you'd comment on is, you know, this isn't unique in Richfield. You know, if money was no object, my guess is Aon would be able to pursue many more endeavors like that. But as you said, Aon's a nonprofit competing with for-profits. And so there needs to be more resources to bear. So there's a lot there, but if you wouldn't mind commenting.
Mr. Arthur.
Yes, Chair Hausman, Representative Howard. Yeah, you know, on the marketplace in March, if I would have predicted about some of the owners of multifamily properties would have been in dire consequences, and I was predicting also that we'd see a lot of foreclosures. I'm not clear that that's the case. I think demand for housing is so great that many of them are getting through this period. And if it doesn't last too much longer, I'm not clear about how many foreclosures we'll have and that opportunity. But there is going to be opportunity that is not going to be, you know, usually when we talk about opportunity like that, we think maybe the prices will fall for these properties. I do not see that happening because it's the law of supply and demand. There's so many investors from the East Coast and West Coast and locally that are chasing these properties that I don't think the costs are going to go down. There is a prediction, recent prediction, that many of these properties are going to come to the market in the next 2 years. And people are seeing this is the time to sell them with the low interest rates out there in the world. And so they are going to change hands. If they change hands, that means the rents have to go up to support both the recapitalization and the equity recovery that the existing owners are going to get. And so, yes, we're going to see a lot of sales skyrocket as being predicted in the next couple of years. And the second question was about, I can't remember what it was now.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just if you're in competition for these properties, at times, and I wonder if you'd comment on sort of if money were no object, so to speak, basically the mismatch of sort of resources that are out there for the nonprofits versus the for-profits.
Madam Chair, Representative Howard, having more capital applied to what is technically an economic problem is absolutely important and critical to save this housing. Whether it be manufactured home parks or NOAAs or anything else, the capital is necessary to solve the problem. It's an economic problem. And I suppose if you raise minimum wage to $30 an hour tomorrow, it would considerably alleviate that problem. I don't expect that to happen. So we're out there, all of us, pitching to try to fix it in this other way. So.
Mr. Worth, any other questions?
Madam Chair, there are no questions in the queue at this time.
Well, there's just a lot of information between these three organizations that have shared with us today. It At our next gathering, we're going to hear from some additional nonprofits that we've been partners with. As it helps to understand that, yes, the challenge is great, but there is so much effort, so much work going on around this. And the nonprofits have helped us and have leveraged a lot of the private dollars as well. So we've concluded our testimony and no more questions. There being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.